Kia ora, I'm Graham. Welcome to episode 9 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Hannah Ireland in her home and studio in Mount Eden, Auckland. Hannah is Ngā Te Hine and Ngā Pui. While still an emerging artist, she has quickly established herself as a unique painter, employing a fresh and gutsy approach to every aspect of her practice. From supports, materials, and mark making that made an immediate and lasting impression on me the first time I encountered her work, and every time since. Hannah holds a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology and a Bachelor of Fine Arts with Honours from the University of Auckland. She has won several awards, including being a Molly Morpeth Canada Award Supreme winner in 2021 and the University of Auckland Chancellor's Award for top Māori and Pacific scholars. She will present her first public solo show at the Te Uru Gallery in Te Tārangi, Auckland in August this year, and has several dealer gallery shows to her name since 2020. She is represented by Yana Millers in Wellington and Larry Payne in Hamilton. In this episode, you'll hear Hannah talk about how her Nana's family photo albums inspired an interest in portraits as an outcome of observation, a determination not to be pigeonholed and using that as a motivation to keep experimenting in materials and supports, learning to embrace not being in control of materials to let surprises happen, that silliness is always very important, and a key moment of discovery in her practice, born out of squishing her art school peers' faces into a photocopier. We started by talking about her growing up being homeschooled.
I suppose because I was homeschooled, there was a lot of creativity that was encouraged. In terms of like projects that we would do, we would always, for example, watch the Olympics and then have to do like a scrapbook with like newspaper cuttings. And I spent way too much time curating my little project books, but I had a lot of fun doing that. And then I guess like we would go to the library and they would have like little colouring competitions. And as you do, you take it away and you can use time out of the school day and do some colouring in. And
so really encouraged by your parents?
Yeah, I want to say definitely. But at the same time, I probably was like a little bit more cheeky and using time in which I should have been using for like math or like reading to kind of like do my own little creative projects.
So you were more drawn to
wanting
to express that way then?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have like any specific memory of a moment where you were like, wow, this is a different thing. This is art as a way for expressing myself is really interesting.
I have a weird like memory of, because I obviously was homeschooled and there was like six of us all being homeschooled at the same time, relatively like the same age. I would, to earn pocket money, draw the outlines of, from, colouring in books,
yeah,
such as like, you know, Disney characters. And I would hold it like a page up to the window and then get like a A3 paper, whatever, and then start tracing. And then I would cut it out. And I would do this in secret. Maybe let's not have this in the podcast. But I would do this in secret and then sell it to my siblings. And like I would tell them that I had drawn it. I was like, look at me, I'm so good at art. And then I would sell them like these little trace drawings that I had convinced them that I drew freehand. And then they would purchase it from me for like 20 cents. And I was like, oh, this is a good thing I got going on. And then I would go to Super Value and buy me my snacks.
So recognizing the value of practice very early.
Yeah, well, I think because my parents also like had their own business, they would sell things online, and I would also help them with that, whether it be like listing items, stock room, packaging, etc. And also, we didn't grow up wealthy, but we grew up in state housing, and there was, like I say, seven kids, mum and dad, in a 3-bedroom house.
That transition, though, from playing with that stuff as a kid and turning it into pocket money, apparently, to realising, obviously, at some point that you wanted to pursue some formal training, that must have happened teenage years. I assume you started thinking, this is something I'd like to explore further.
Yes. Well, I think, like, in terms of, it got me in, I think, thinking about art and, like, making art, doing those little activities. But I think when I started really thinking about, okay, like, what are you doing? Like, you're just tracing things. I kind of, like, fell into this little interest of how can I do it freehand? Hmm. And then in that I got really into, like, realism.
Hmm.
And, like, sitting and, like, taking time to actually consider the way in which one can represent things as what it would look like.
Your perception of something and then and recreating
it. Yeah, but I got really fixed on, like, realism. I would spend, like, ages, like, hours and hours, and I was sat really late doing what I thought was realism at the time. But it wasn't. Like, looking back, it's like a little bit of a pathetic excuse for realism.
Well, but you're, what, 14, 15?
No, I think I would have been, like, 11.
Oh,
like,
yeah, 12. So then, yeah, yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I would spend my, maths time in my bedroom doing drawing, realism drawing, and I would use, like, magazines such as, like, Cream or Girlfriend as, like, the
reference material,
and I would, like, sketch Kelly Clarkson or, like, Hilary Duff and try my best to, like, do it. And then, yeah, I guess when my mum would come to check on me, I would quickly, like, scuffle the papers away. I'm like, I'm doing my math. There's nothing to see here. But, yeah, no, I had definitely just got, like, a lot of kick out of trying to make something very representational. Because you had to be, like, you've got to have, like, a little bit of an analytical eye. And there is, I got a lot of kick out of
recreating something.
Yeah.
As close to
something. And it felt like a high. And so in that, when I was 17, I asked my parents if I could go to high school.
Was that a big deal? Was it quite hard to go to your parents and say, I know we've been homeschooling here, but I want to go to school?
It was a very big deal.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a big deal.
For you and your parents?
For the whole family.
Hmm.
For the whole family. Because I'm the middle child out of 8 of us. And so none of, like, the older children had gone to school, except for my eldest brother, who got pulled out of primary when he was 7, when my mum started homeschooling.
Hmm.
And so no one had been to any formal public schooling except for him. And so, yes, it was a very big deal for me to even ask to go.
And do you remember what that drive was for you to want to go to school?
Yes, I wanted to learn science. Huh. I wanted to learn more than what we were allowed to learn at home school. I think it was very, like, confined.
Enough Bunsen burners at home.
No, well, I grew up in faith. Like, my parents are Christian.
Yeah.
And so the way in which they had scaffolded the way that they would give us education didn't encompass science.
Mm.
And if it did, it was more honed into, like, in the 7 days God created, etc. And I think I was very, like, inquisitive of things just in general. Like, there must be more, or, like, why does something happen? And I think I kind of felt very frustrated in the full stops that I kept getting met with.
Mm.
And so I kind of pondered and thought about it, and I was like, I want something more for myself than to not go through formal training of any form and not even to have the luxury of meeting people, like, in public schools. Yeah, I wanted something more than what me and my siblings had been given. And I'm not saying that wasn't enough for them it may be.
Well, but to satisfy your, you're going to have a different curiosity to everyone else. Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely.
So, and did you make it to I because of my age, I'm going to say sixth form, seventh form.
And because I'm homeschooled, I'm going to look at you confused. I'm going to be like, what are you talking about?
Well,
year 11.
Year 11, yeah. Okay. So you made it to year 11 before university?
Yes. I had to, well, the whole drive, I guess, essentially, I had a conversation with my parents to go to high school, and they were like, why? That was their question, and rightly so. Why, Hannah? Why do you want to go to high school? And at that time, I don't know, I felt like I was a very empathetic kid, and I just really liked being helpful. And so in my mind, in the environment that I was in, it was like healthcare. That's it. That's the best way that you can like be helpful. And so I had orchestrated this like idea and like this proposal to my parents, and I was like,
societal contribution stuff.
Yes. I was like, let me go so I can study healthcare. You know, like, I need to go to high school so that I can go to university, and then fingers crossed, hopefully I'll get into medicine.
This is a much clearer plan than I had when I was 15 or 16, by the way.
I was 17 at this time.
Yeah.
I mean, so, likewise, though. Like, yeah. And like, amongst other things, like, I guess my parents have always had different expectations for me in terms of capabilities, and they would compare me to my siblings, which very problematic thing to do, I think.
Anyone with a sibling can relate to that.
Yeah. And so I was always felt that I could do something much more than being a teacher, such as my mum, or like going into the trades, such as my dad. And so I went into high school with this kind of like, okay, I'm going to go to high school with the intention of going into university so that I can study medicine. And in doing that, because I had no academic history to my name in the public sphere, I had to enroll as a year 11 student when I was 17. And I didn't mind at all, because I guess, firstly, I haven't learned what anyone else in the classroom had learned. And I was just like really thrilled that I would be able to learn what they were going, you know, we were going to be taught. And so,
amazing attitude for a kid to take into school.
I mean, I was just very excited. I felt like it was my first day of primary.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, I get to learn. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it was very cool. And then also people. I get to mix with other people. Yeah. Just like, bye, siblings. Fine at home.
Because siblings had more or less been your world for a long time.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. You love them, you hate them, you have to live with them. Yeah.
Okay, again, I can relate. Yeah. I've got a sibling. So that set you up then to be able to attend university?
Yes, it did. It did. And I went to a new kind of like 21st century high school where they would essentially craft the subjects or like the amount of time that you spend with teachers in order to get you to where you want to go.
Yeah.
And that it was known amongst all the teachers that Hannah's only here, this homeschooled girl, so that essentially she can get into a really good university and be a doctor. And so that was on everyone's like minds. And yes, I was treated differently. And yes, it was felt amongst the students. But I think it was also the same, like at the same time to me, like at times not a weight that I wanted to bear. Because it felt weird at times. But at times I really loved it because I also got to like spend time with teachers and have adult conversations. I don't know. Because sometimes, especially going in like being 2 years older than students and not having the same kind of like parallel life experiences, conversations that and the concerns that people would have, I would eye roll at them at times because I was just like, what the heck are you talking about?
Yeah, well, I think we probably all have, regardless of when we attend school, conflicted experiences of it, pros and cons. So,
Yeah. No, but yes, it did set me up, I guess, and was very fortunate.
To then go on to a degree, like double degree at Auckland University, University of Auckland. So psychology and so a BA in psychology and your Bachelor of Fine Arts. Which is quite a lot to bite off.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to the high school thing, essentially, I got into pre-med and I got a full paid scholarship to the University of Auckland. Oh. So everyone's community working effort to get me there got me there. I wouldn't say it was like my own personal feat to get there. It was definitely group effort. But yeah, got there in the end. But it wasn't really what I wanted to do. Like upon reflection of doing my first year at pre-med.
You only find that stuff out once you're into it.
Yeah, definitely.
So then you moved and then or I moved. Switched to psychology and then the BFA.
I did a cheeky switch, which my parents did not like. Because they were like, what? You left? Firstly, you went to public school with this intention of like doing medicine. You got there. You got a full paid scholarship. What are you up to? Like, why do you want to paint pictures?
They're considering you off the rails because you're doing a double degree.
Everyone thought I was, no, at this time I just said fine arts.
Right.
And so then I went back and reflected on it. And then I was like, okay, I will pick up psychology as well. Like, I have interests in people, like I like to think. And it will keep the parents happy. And it did.
It's a really interesting combination. Did you have a plan for how you were going to combine the BA in psychology and a BFA? Or no. Much like lots of people, including me at university, happy accident of two interesting degrees for you?
I think it was a happy accident.
Yeah.
Because I knew where I wanted to go. I wanted to do the fine arts degree. And I, in my mind, had re-evaluated things and kind of was like, okay, I want to be a secondary school art teacher. That is my goal. When I get spat out of uni, like, I would be more than happy. This way I can, like, contribute to the arts in a way in which I can also feel satisfied and also maybe have my own little creative endeavours on the side.
Yeah.
And kind of, like, whisper into students' ears to be like, study fine arts. Like, it's not that scary. Like, you know, medicine isn't everything. But, yeah, it was a happy accident. Because after I made that decision to study fine arts, I then had to think about, okay, another degree. What's another degree that you can have, like, a viable job coming out of? And I know that that's probably sad to say, but sometimes there aren't many viable jobs after you study fine arts. So that just happened to be psychology in my...
Well, it goes back, I suppose, to wanting to care for people as well, right? Mm.
And it was still in the healthcare.
Yeah.
And so, like, I knew that my parents would understand. And they loved it. They loved that I picked psychology over finance. So they were like, oh, now it makes sense.
Yeah.
Now it makes sense. And I was like, yeah, I guess it makes sense.
I've got to know, have you won your parents over now that you're in a dedicated practice?
Maybe mid last year I won them over. Going back to my upbringing and... the kind of lifestyle that we had where we didn't have much, I can understand why it's very important for my parents, especially when they homeschooled us, to set us up. You kind of like give a lot to your kids and then to set them up so that they can also have like a better life. I can fully understand why they wanted me to like pursue a job that I could make money out of.
Mm.
But in that... they only realised last year, but I think it's just because they are now saying that it is a viable job, and I personally don't think that I've been trying to make it, I don't know, viable in the fact of, like, selling, etc. I think I just do what I love, and I am very fortunate that people really hold on to that and grab it, and they like it too, and it's quite, a little pat on the back, kind of, that tug and pull between having to wrestle with conversations with my parents about a viable job and me being like, no, but I really love this, and that tug and pull between money or like happiness.
Mm.
And like, I kind of am now in this like mixture of best worlds, which I never thought I would be in. It's kind of strange. My parents, they've definitely come back around.
So that's probably a good transition into talking about, well, for me, first experience of your work, which was at Sant Gallery in 2020. And looking at your work, totally fresh, had never seen it before, I was really struck by not just the really unique outcome of the work. In fact, to be honest, I was looking at the work thinking, what the hell am I looking at? And I mean that in the best possible way. But then looking at it more, and especially the way that you're applying paint to glass, the approach of applying materials to the support was really interesting as well. So I'm curious to know how you got to that point, because it's a really unique approach.
Yeah. Well, I actually got to that. I arrived at that point through my first project in the second semester I had at Elam. I had Simon Ingram. He was shout out.
Is this your tutor?
My tutor, yeah, Simon Ingram. And our brief essentially was looking at modes of making through process and mark making. And in that, I've always loved portraiture. And so I was thinking, how the heck do I do this? How do I mix the two when, especially going into art school, thinking that I wanted to do, like, realism? So, okay, you want me to focus on less about the subject and more about the process and more about, like, the marks that you're making. Okay, but I want to do what I want to do. So it was, like, this kind of, like, mixing of, like, okay, how do I loosen up a bit to kind of, like, consider everything. But in that, I started the project wanting material, and in that, as you do, well, as people do on Pinterest or whatnot, you go to the copy machine, you squish your face up, you start scanning, you do the, yeah. And for some reason, I've orchestrated 7 of my fellow peers to come up with me and, like, squish their face up. And they're like, what the heck are you doing? I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. But I need to start with some kind of, like, matter, like, some subject matter. As a reference material. Mm. And I need it obscured. First step to obscure it. And then in that, I was like, okay, well, that's kind of gone through a mode of process, like a process that has kind of, it's gone through a channel that has kind of obscured the actual thing that you're looking at.
The actual subject,
yes. Mm. And in that, I felt like, oh, that's quite nice. So there's a hand kind of, like, removed from your own intention and the way that it's been captured. And then in that, I got fixated on the piece of glass that everyone was squishing their face up against.
So, like, literally on the photocopier.
Yeah, I got fixated with that for some reason, because I was like, this is such a silly, like, exercise. But I've always told myself, don't excuse silliness. Silliness is very important.
Yeah.
And if it's not going to harm anyone, like, might as well just do your little exercise, and there's going to be an outcome whether there's an avenue to follow or not. And so in that, yeah, I got really fixated on the plate of glass that people were kind of squishing their face up against. And then I was, like, considering, like, the output and the way that it had obscured portraiture or, like, the faces. And then in that, I started considering, oh, what happens if I, like, print out the piece of paper with the photograph, shall I say, or the scanned copy of their face.
The photocopy of a smushed face.
Yes, yeah. Out, and then stick an actual piece of glass on top and then start painting over it. So as you paint, then the image underneath starts to, like, disappear.
This is a really interesting echo of the industry that you're running and selling to your siblings.
I know it is. It's so weird. I know, like, it all does come around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated that there's, like, a photocopier at Elam at the University of Auckland that's the genesis of your window paintings.
Yes, yes. And it's not the cheap kind. Like, it's the ones where you should be scanning, like, very old documents. And I'm sorry, guys, whoever uses those, like, that I did that. But, like, yeah, I'm sure I'm not the first student or will be the last student. But, yes, no, that was the starting point. And then in that, like I said, put a piece of plate glass down on the printout of the photocopied printout of a person's face, and then started painting in oils on the piece of glass on that. And I got really fixated with, like, the technicolor that kind of spat out.
Because of the way material's reacting on glass, you mean?
Because, yes, yes. And people would move as well. Like, I would encourage movement, like, to obscure even more. And so you've got, like, the light shining through, and then you've got, like, a zigzag.
I see, yeah.
And, yeah, people may have jewellery on, and then it, like, spits back. So I got really fixated on, like, what the machinery could do in order to, like, obscure an image in the one-step removed process that it kind of entailed. And because I really like... I like having my hand in... How do I phrase this? I don't like feeling out of control.
Hmm.
And... life in general, I don't like that sensation. It makes me feel very anxious and weird. But in this, I've kind of realized, like, through reflecting upon oneself, and then from that project, kind of like encouraged myself to lose control a bit, to find modes of making that I am one step removed, but also have my hand in, and that it's not a scary thing. And so, and to encourage surprises. And so, I got really, yeah, also in conjunction of getting really fixated on the piece of glass that people would squish their faces up to, I got
on
really...
this poor photocopy.
Yeah, yeah. I got also, sorry, got really fixated on the way in which I could push, I could kind of like engage with modes of making where I was involved, but also one step removed. So there is a conversation occurring. There is... Oh, you have to actually, like, pause, and the material will tell you what it wants. But at the same time, you can also have a hand in asking and, like, also telling them what you want at the same time. So it's kind of like negotiation space I kind of fell into, and I really appreciated in this... Yeah, I guess that was the start of it, that project.
I want to step back to... You said you've always been fascinated by portraiture.
Mm.
So where does that come from? Why the fascination with portraits?
Why am I fascinated with portraiture? Growing up, I've kind of like fell into the position of the observer, the one that doesn't necessarily say anything in terms of that contributes to the matters or the affairs of the family. And... yeah, isn't young child that is also listened to. So I feel like I just fell into, like, the observer role. And I really like watching people. It's one of my favourite activities.
So having living portraits around you.
Yeah. And also my nana would document, like, us kids. We'd all have photo albums, an album each. And it would just be, like, a collation of, like, portraiture, essentially, just photos of us. And I bear no memory of specific photographs that were taken or shot, but for some reason, well, I know why, my nana was very important to me. So therefore, like, this body of, I don't know, this albums, they were really, like, fascinating to me. And I liked looking at what she looked at and why she felt that it was important to snap. And, yeah, I don't... It was probably, like, one of my favourite things to do growing up was looking through those albums.
Which is a really lovely direct line to portraiture, as opposed to... You know, I was thinking about this in your work as a portrait artist in the context of, you know, art history. And they've probably got this quite wrong preparing for the interview, where the tradition of portraiture painting is someone surrounded by the most important objects to them, a demonstration of wealth, dressed in their finery. You subvert all of that. You strip all of that away. So that's that process of portraiture for you is more about that direct line to photographs of family portraits than any tradition of portraiture in art history.
Yeah. Definitely.
So you haven't very consciously looked at the tradition of portraiture and art history and thought, I want to subvert that. I want to make it a lot more straightforward.
No, not at all.
Instead, you've just thought, what is a different view? What is a different point of observation?
Yeah. Yes. I also, like, going through and thinking about subject matter and portraiture, my own personal experience with portraiture and my favorite activity of watching people. I think I like sat with that for a moment and thought, portraiture seems to always bring out the best in people, and it is representational. And yes, you are surrounded by your prized possessions.
The traditionally.
Yeah. But for me, it feels at times that there's a lack of like emotive sensation, and the possessions that we hold within, like, that isn't being shown or captured. And yeah, it kind of feels at times glazed over, like a traditional kind of like portrait at times. Yes, they're beautifully stunning and technically, like, I don't know if I could ever do it, but to me at times there seems to be this lack of something that's deeper. There's something that you can't grasp on.
When you look at traditional portraiture, there's not, and the irony is, in traditional portraiture trying to capture someone, you don't feel like you actually see the essence of who that person is.
No, not at all. No, I don't. I often wonder, like, how many portraits actually look like the person, if they're trying to capture them in the light. I think there are these kind of social ideals about what is beautiful, and that is enhanced in traditional portraiture. And so even then, maybe it is obscured as well, for whatever that is. But
they're a strange thing, traditional portrait paintings.
Yeah.
That crosses into... I know someone that at least was influential in your work. So, you know, reading your graduate show notes. So a Canadian sociologist called Irving Goffman, who famously, or at least his most famous book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, where he talked about the imagery of theatre. Your work was partly inspired by reading some of his work.
The way in which I work is typically I go off a whim and I go with my gut and I go with how I feel in relation to the contents and the scenario and, like, the people that surround me and the coordinates, etc. That's how I work. And going through Elam, I would like to think that I was a maker and not necessarily a researcher. And so I would think through ideas and kind of have conversations with myself, and then it would get to a point like, oh, you've got to do like a small dissertation, like, for your curriculum, end of year essay. And in that, as you do naturally, I think we all do, we go like looking for what we want to see, or like what we want to encourage or support our arguments, or kind of give us an understanding to strengthen that. And so in that, I found Irving Goffman. I really liked the way in which he phrased, or like his theory in which he kind of like staged how everyone negates space. Yes. And how we all, hey Siri, how we all play different roles, and how we code switch, and how we negate different settings, and how we kind of have this outside negotiation and this internal negotiation. And to me, it kind of felt like reading his theory that I found something that kind of grounded my thinking, my own personal thinking, my own personal thinking, in which I would have thoughts that I would have while watching people, because I just couldn't articulate it. And watching people go from one group to another and hold themselves so differently, and then even that journey between the two groups.
And there must be some observation that you're bringing forward from growing up with six siblings, seven of you, right?
There's eight of us, siblings.
Seven siblings and you. So there must be an element of that you grew up with as well, bringing that forward into that observation and therefore practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they're probably my most studied subjects. I mean, like, amongst us siblings, we would all fall into having different roles. Like, my older sister, obviously, the older one, the nurturing one, the one that had to be responsible, kind of like the law keeper of... And then you've got, like, the youngest child who can play up and in front of our parents, which is another setting, an environment, might be like at clueless. Like, what? I don't know what's happening. And you're kind of just like, what? Like, confronted with this, but you just, what? You were being so cheeky just before, and you were like so okay with it. And now parents come in a new setting, and now you're...
There's a switch.
There's a switch of the way in which you're holding yourself and regulating the way in which you're coming across. And it's just interesting and fascinating.
You said about your paintings in your Elam grad show that they are a theatrical reality, an assemblage of fragmented information. These paintings echo the perplexing nature of identity and the potentiality of what could be hovers. So that piece, especially the potentiality of what could be hovers, is that why characters appear to look fluid, you know, if not melting? in your painting sometimes, like you're hinting at the shape-shifting nature of how people present themselves in just different situations.
Yes, definitely. And at the same time, I'm also aware of my own personal felt coordinates of painting a picture or making something that is a part of the fragmented information. And then what is spat out is all the potentiality of what hovers, kind of thing. It's like a mixture.
And a reflection of that time with, you know, family and siblings, and also what you were seeing presumably with different group dynamics at Elam or in life at that point.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I also am like a believer in the fact that everyone, we all have our own little collation of experiences, and they do expand as time goes on. And that is a makeup of an individual, and whether we know it or not, bits of information come to the forefront and slip to the back.
So in that sense, you're interested in the experiences of others, or is it that middle ground of the different experiences that we all have?
I think it's this experience of this mutual ground. It might not be a shared specific experience, but I feel like we definitely all have a mutual ground in experiencing having to hold or dress ourselves in signifiers or like...
To present ourselves in a way that we want to be seen.
Essentially.
Although your subjects are always persistently asymmetrical, I can't help but think of Rorschach inkblot tests when I look at your work. Mm. So have they been a reference material as well?
No, not at all. I think why they potentially might look like blobs of water or ink on the support material is because it's a way in which my first initial response is to get it out there, get it down, try to think about it so like consciously. Because it's in reverse, I guess, build it up from there.
Mm.
But yes, no. But I don't like those tests. I know.
You don't like them?
No. I mean, yeah, no.
Well, even if they're not a reference point, it seems that you're still wanting to toy with our brains a little bit, especially that piece that humans have of wanting to see faces, you know, where there aren't necessarily faces. So I think the phenomenon is called facial pareidolia, where, you know, you see a face in a wall plug or a toaster. So you seem to sometimes only give us the, you know, barest information in a painting, but still present a face for us to see.
Yes.
And is that a want for you to straddle a fine line between representational painting and abstraction?
I think partly. I think the other part might be to do with not wanting to make the viewer feel as though they need to infer something in a certain way. I quite appreciate when I'm not forced to be told to think a certain or to perceive something in a certain light. And so I think I like to give the audience that kind of luxury or that kind of like courtesy to infer and to kind of look within themselves and to see what they want to see. And that, I think, that opens the conversation wide up, like opens it up for everyone to kind of have their own little hand in being able to talk to and talk with and then be spoken back to, I think.
So implying that you're leaving just enough ambiguity in the work for us to be able to basically, you know, project ourselves onto or thoughts onto.
Yeah.
So getting into support a little bit, which we'll return to when we talk about support materials a little later in conversation, but I've wondered if glass, especially you painting on the reverse or other side of the glass that you present to us, is that a hint that you're suggesting there's, you know, that thin veneer sometimes between our exterior presentation to the world and who sits behind it? It's a, it seems like a really neat trick of a support to do. So is that by design?
Yes, well, in stumbling upon glass, I did consider this a lot, and thinking about like skin and screens and the way that we curate ourselves online. I thought, I would like to think it does speak to that. And I also like the way in which I can't control, at times, the way in which a painting looks, because it wants to slide, it wants to move.
Because of the support, the
because
nature
of the
glass.
Support. Yeah. And so I found that really interesting, this kind of like connection, or this kind of like, it does speak to this kind of barrier, but it's transparent and you can see through.
Because your subjects are always peering out from behind that barrier to us, at least in the glass paintings. We're going to talk about other supports, but
yeah.
You entered a work into the Kingi Tuheitia Portraiture Award in 2021 that the New Zealand Portrait Gallery run. And I'm assuming that most of your subjects are largely fictional, but the nature of that award, and for benefit of listeners, conceptually that award is about asking emerging Māori artists to create portraits of tūpuna. So in this case, I'm assuming that entry was a real person, an ancestor. Was it? And how did you go about approaching that work, you know, to enter into that competition? Which, by the way, if you're listening, New Zealand Portrait Gallery, I think conceptually it's a fantastic award.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I'll start off by saying that my mum was adopted out when she was a baby. And my mum is Māori. And so she was adopted into an Irish family. Of a solo mum, sort of, yes, by an Irish lady. And she grew up central Auckland as a Māori young woman in the 50s. And so she didn't know anything about her whakapapa. And me growing up, it was known amongst, obviously, us and our and the kids that... Mum was adopted out and we're Māori, but we are Māori, but we don't have anything to cling to. There's nothing there. All that was said on her birth certificate is this given name that her birth mother gave to the registry, which was Queenie, and the last name, which was Tipine. And at this point, we didn't even know if it was like a real name. And amongst having like several conversations with my mum growing up, there was a hint of, I suppose, rejection for whatever reasons, whether it's like the social kind of like parameters that she grew up, the social setting, central Auckland being like a Māori kid centrally, that's not easy.
Again, and, removed from whenua, no understanding of whakapapa.
Definitely. And obviously being othered. Because she looks Māori, so not white passing, so that's another added layer. And I have always wanted to know where I come from, but in that, it doesn't disregard the fact that I'm Māori. I know that I'm Māori, but I understand the importance of connection to whakapapa and whenua. It's a sensitive thing because you want to be respectful to your parents. And first and foremostly, it's not my experience where she was adopted out. It is her experience. And in that, there was always reservations as to whether she felt that she had the capacity to reach out to family. But by firstly starting to look for family, because we didn't know where to look. We knew that we come from Ngāpuhi. We knew that our hapū's Ngātahine, but in that, it's still kind of like, what do you do? And Quinn is, we will later find out it's not actually the name. Like, you know, so it was just this complicated journey, I guess, or like...
So a portrait again, but wanting to capture, so your mum?
My mum, yeah.
But some of her whakapapa as well in the portrait?
So essentially what, yeah, the portrait is my grandmother, Queen Etipene, and it kind of is a reflection, in my mind, in making this work, of this hovering shadow that's always been in conversation with us, this figure that has been a part of our lives, has been very much on our thoughts, but who is this actual, like, embodiment? Like, who is this person in space? Who are they? And so I think the only way that I could negate painting a portrait of my tūpuna was by making it a silhouette, was by also representing me in that portrait as well, at the forefront, and knowing that they've always been there, they've always been a part of the conversation. And in this conversation, one thing that I noted in this painting, and I thought it was very important for me to include and try and make it, like, seen, was the nose. Because growing up, like, my dad's Irish, Scottish, English. Love you, Dad. Pakeha. Yeah. And my mum's Māori. And so growing up, like, especially with us 8 kids, there's like a mixture of features. And I am very fortunate that I hold a lot of the Māori features. And so I've got a small flat nose. And my siblings, they've got like pointier noses. And then a variation in between. So it's, yeah, my nose is my mum's nose. And in that, I used to get bullied. Like, oh, you've got a small nose. And for me, I just like, oh, why can't I have a big pointy nose? You know, like, that's what I've always wanted. And but then I, as I grew up and started thinking more consciously about it, it kind of like dawned on me. I was like, oh, if I've got my mum's nose, then I have my grandma's nose or my granddad's nose, and I've got my, you know, I've got the Māori nose. And so in that portrait, is even though it's just like a silhouette sitting behind, I've given each of the figures the same nose, the small button flat nose.
So for you, and, an exploration and connection.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's a lovely way to approach tūpuna.
Well, that's the only way that I, yeah, I guess also at that time I was still trying to figure out or negate a space of how can I reconnect, whether it's just in an internal kind of conversation without going out actively and behind my mum's back, and yet still be respectful and engaging and hopefully having conversations that would come out of this portraiture award, which it did. Which is great, and yeah, there was no harm done.
A useful, challenging exercise presented by the New Zealand Portrait Gallery.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that said, I'm super curious about other subjects. So are they, I'm assuming they're almost a fictional composite of at least some real experiences of people in general. So do you draw on, you know, specific people for portrait work, or, as I say, is it just that? Are they composites of all sorts of interactions?
I think the way that I like to see it is that when I'm engaging in a conversation or engaging in a situation, a setting, I'm inferring. So you may be saying something to me right now. I'm going to take what I want to hear or what I can hear from that, and I'm going to infer from that what I think you've said. And so, like, when I kind of, like, make these portraits, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily somebody, because I'm perceiving, I'm inferring. I don't think I could actually do that. I don't think I can represent someone.
So they're more your reflections of experiencing those people than,
than them. And then I also think it's a mixture of also a bit of me, like my inference going on. But then I also think because of the process, it's a bit of them. So it essentially becomes their own like entity, its own thing. So, yeah.
An in-between of the two.
Yes, definitely an in-between.
I've heard you refer to the works quite often as friends, and I don't know if I'm missing a joke here, but that suggests a real intimacy and familiarity with subjects, even if they're fictional or living in that in between space. So it sounds like you really care about those characters, and why is that?
Why is that? I think it just stems back to the conversations that we have. And I will say we because I believe that they're living and breathing in their own way.
The portraits, not any subjects in real life.
The portraits. Yeah. It comes back to the quiet intimacy moments that you have in the studio and the conversations that occurs, whether it's actually applying material down onto supports and then the whole construction of the figure. I think it speaks back to me. I speak to it. And then... So therefore, we do become acquainted, and I wouldn't say it's always a pleasurable like time making.
Because sometimes it's difficult.
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. It doesn't want to do what I want to do, and it wants to do its own thing, and I just kind of have to like be okay with that. And so, they are my friends ultimately, and maybe weirdly, like when I come into the studio, I'll say hi, like I talk to them, and when I install a show, like I like to make sure that they're okay. And if they're not okay, I would like to think that I can feel that they're not okay and something needs to happen.
Yeah, because I've also heard you talk about, or that you care about where work ends up and who it ends up with.
Mm.
So that's a reflection of that as well, that, again, they're friends of sorts.
Yeah, definitely. And I also feel like in the conversations that we're having, whether I'm trying to mediate something in my mind or a situation or digest something or dissect something, I feel like the painting themselves, they give me a lot. And so I feel like the least that I can do is make sure that where they end up is in a very good home as much as I can. At first, I really didn't like the idea of even giving away works, like or even like selling works. Because in my mind, I was like, no, they're their own entity. They're their own thing. That's so bad to have this exchange with like monetary value. Why? No, like that's so disrespectful.
So how have you come to terms with that? How have you made peace with that process?
I think the way that I've come to negate this in my mind is to not assume that, or to not let that be a restricting factor for them to go live on in another way, in another facet, and to not let the parameters of my mind or in this conversation to let it be a restricting kind of mode or a thing that kind of hinders them from having further conversations outside of the conversations that I could have with them.
Right, so you want them to go out and have different conversations with different people.
I think I do now. Before I was like, no, that's for me. Yeah, but now, yeah. No, I think, yeah. I love it when they have conversations with other people. Mm. And I don't need to be involved with the conversations that are going on. It can be quiet and intimate between the viewer and the painting, and I'm fine.
Nice.
Yeah.
I want to talk about process for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you start a work? Like, do you have a really strong conceptual idea of a specific work or a body of work that you want to produce?
No. I wouldn't say necessarily I have an idea of a body of work that I would like to produce. I think typically it will start from thinking about materials and what kind of supports I want to use or kind of like modes of making I want to adopt or modes, multiple, like that I want to meld through. And then letting that be the departure point of then thinking about subject. I guess because I always concern my practice with the body and portraiture, thinking about material first and foremost seems more important because I know kind of where it's going to go is going to be concerned about setting and people. And then in that, I will think about, okay, I've got, I guess, the process, the supports that I want to use. Then I'll think about, okay, now what do I want to depict?
Mm.
And then...
So that really, that depiction really comes last.
Yes, to me it does. And typically it might just even happen on a whim of just like, okay, go. You've got all your material set up, now go do it.
So quite an abstract approach before something representational appears.
Yeah, no, I think so. I've got to make sure that I'm kind of like one step removed, but also have a hand, yeah.
Well, we talked about, perhaps close to that, we talked about problem solving before, or something that I quite often ask artists is where problem solving fits in their practice. But for you, it seems like for you, embracing problems or the lack of control over materials is absolutely what a good part of the practice is. Like you seem, or you almost seem like the Evel Knievel of painting in that sense, where you're, you know, you're willing to kind of perform these stunts with materials to see what happens.
Yes, I think it's exciting. I think it's, that's, to have a lack of that is potentially stepping away from this potentiality of magic, or like, I don't know, like, it's exciting. That's where you get your kicks out of, like, you know, like, that's where I get mine out of. Just like this element of surprise. And I've often referred to it, like with friends, as like Kinder surprises. You know, you don't know what you're going to get. And then you open it up and you'll get a toy, regardless.
So you don't know what you're going to get when you start at work.
No. I think, and that's important to me as well.
How much of that lack of control is your work?
I mean, I can give it parameters. And that's probably why setting up and thinking of and considering materials and process is important, because there is going to be lack of control. But I don't know, I would like to say it's 50-50.
Yeah.
I can obviously like put down colour, I can do an outline, I can do all these things, but the in-between, or like the way that it will come across, I don't know if I can control that as much. But I would like to say that I can, but I can't. But I like it like that.
Well, it seems like, maybe this is a reflection of how relatively early you are in career, but it seems like you're really cognizant of everything being an experiment still, of wanting to really experiment with different supports and different materials.
Yes.
So is that accurate?
Yes. I've always been excited by materials. I think it's very important. And at the same time, I would be kidding if I was to not, like, consider my position in the art sphere, and that being, up to this point, purely in the private sector, where it is very commercial. And in that, I got really scared because, or maybe scared's not the right word, but it kind of just happened, me being in the commercial sphere, or like even being an artist, like it really just happened. And I mean, I'm here for the ride. I like it.
You've found quite a bit of success relatively early in career.
Yes. And in that, I think one thing that did scare me was to be pigeonholed as someone that only uses a particular set of materials in a particular way. And I didn't want that to happen to me. Because first and foremost, I guess, you come out of your honours, and or even once you've graduated, people will see what you're making and they assume or can infer that that's it. And that's all you're capable of. And to me, I'm like, no, I can do so much more. Like, and I'm a maker. I like material. I like to keep learning and like experimenting. I think it's very important. And so in that, I think I also made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to be pigeonholed in this sphere that I'm in this commercial sphere. And I need to keep my creative endeavor open for me personally, to keep myself excited and interested in what I'm doing, but to not also treat myself as like an output, or like a little factory of like doing something.
Well, let's talk about that variation then, because there's been a lot, as you say, to keep it interesting for yourself. So most recently, a group of work that was silk and fabric dye, brand new support, brand new material for you.
Yeah.
So again, that's part of wanting to experiment a lot.
Yes, it was. I had an urge, and it's kind of scary. It's kind of probably scary for like people that I say that I'll do a show with. Or four, because I have these big ideas in my head.
And scary for you. In this case, you mean your dealer, Jana Millis?
I do think so.
Poor Jana.
I think it's scary. She's probably like, what the heck are you up to? But, I mean, I think Jana also has like this really good understanding of how I operate.
Mm.
And I need this creative endeavor and pursuit. And I don't know, I need to follow it. But anyway, yes. I had an amazing idea that I'll do silk. And it kind of stemmed from my last show, the year prior, my last solo show, where I worked on canvases.
Mm.
And in that, my brother and I, we made a garment together. And I wanted a piece of the garment to have silk because I thought silk looks nice. And he wasn't too. He was like, okay. So, as I do, went away and did what I wanted to do and came back. Anyway.
And this was you painting on silk?
Yes.
For the garment?
With fabric dye.
Mm.
Yes. And so he was on Drag Race down under and he had asked if I could help him make this dress or paint on this dress. And in making painting on this dress, I had to make 40 paintings. But essentially it was going to be his like grand finale dress if he had
40 paintings stitched together into a single garment.
Into a single garment, yeah.
Great, that's what happened. Great.
Yeah. And so that was going to be his finale dress if he had been crowned Down Under.
Down Under Drag Queen.
Down Under Drag Queen.
Yeah, cool.
Drag Race Down Under, yeah. But in that, fortunately, the judges didn't know what they were doing. They didn't crown him.
Nor your dress.
Yeah, nor our dress. So in that last solo show, he wore it to the exhibition, which is really lovely. He came in drag, and that was nice. Yeah. And then from that moment, it had always been like in the back of my mind, just that kind of like 3 weeks of working on silk and me being like, oh, I want to revisit that. Like, what can we do now? What can we do next? And so after that solo show, I thought it'd be kind of like appropriate to itch that kind of like itch.
Well, they're a beautiful contradiction, those works, because they look, I suppose, like your subjects often do, frankly, quite harsh figures in the portraits. You know, they're ill-formed, melting faces. But then there's a wonderful softness to them because of the silk and the ink dye. So again, a happy accident coming out of that, or did you have an idea because of that, the work you'd done with the dress, that that's where you were going to end up?
Working on the silk was quite difficult for me. I thought maybe I didn't consider it in terms of too much of, okay, what are the processes or like processes that are occurring that it needs to feed through before I have a hand in putting out the subject matter onto the support. It was kind of just like straight on. It was kind of like what you see is what you get. And to me, I couldn't grapple with it initially in making this body of work. I was like, oh, so it's like drawing. I don't draw. Once upon a time, I guess like I did representational work, but now I'm like feel in my mind that I've departed from that port. And now I'm like using material where I probably didn't consider it as much of, in terms of thinking, oh, okay, once you put the dye down, like you're actually a lot in control.
You're in more control than you wanted to be.
I think in some parts I was in control.
Yeah.
Yes. Like the ones that look, there's definitely ones that look more representational.
There are.
And then there's others that aren't. And I think I had to think about water a lot and the application of water I don't know. I think because I was using lots of like concentrated dye, once I put it on the silk just kind of ate it.
At different concentrations.
Yeah.
So so silk sounds like it's been one of almost your nemesis so far, one of the more challenging supports to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't, yeah. Love, hate, hate it. Like, yeah. No.
Well, you're going to go back to window frames for a show, because you have a show at Te Uru in Auckland, out in Te Tārangi.
Yes.
So back to window frames for that. So as a, you know, as a support material, where the hell do all the window frames come from?
The window frames. This is a good question. No. Well, I've been very fortunate that Dad wanted to be a tradie growing up, even before I existed. Yeah, so no, he's, yeah, been a tradie, and now he owns his own company. And him and my brothers are also followed in my dad's footsteps. They're tradies too, and so whenever they go into a house to renovate, they always think, oh, what about these windows? Will Hannah want these windows? I'm like, yeah.
So you've got your family out there sourcing support material for you.
Yeah. Well, that's yes. And then also like trade me as well, right, which is cool. I mean, always on the hunt out for windows.
And you're going to take that, with that show at Te Uru, you're planning on taking it one step further in terms of windows. So you're explaining outside of this conversation that you're going to put those, place those windows into walls within the gallery space.
Yes.
So further to reinforce that element of your subjects looking out.
Yes, I think so. And also moving around, looking out, moving around, having this kind of conversation, the back to the front. What side of the glass are you on? What kind of conversation is occurring? But yes, essentially, I really want to put a wall in. My dad will help me with that. Thanks, Dad. and we'll fix it into the wall, which will hopefully look really sick.
I'm really hoping that visitors will be able to walk around the back of the paintings. Is that the intention as well?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Because seeing the application of paint on the reverse, I'm trying to think of that as the right word to apply to the back of your paintings, given they're also the front of your paintings.
Yeah,
I really want people to be able to walk around and see the back of them, because the back of them are as fascinating as the front in many ways.
Yes, no, definitely. I've been thinking about it too, because, I mean, essentially when I first started painting on glass, I never showed anyone the backs. I thought it was sacred, that only I could see it. Hmm. It was for my eyes only. As I've, like, progressed in my practice and, like, thinking through things, I think it's another conversation to be had with a viewer. And potentially the reason why I felt that at the time was because I wasn't ready to have that conversation or let the work have that conversation at that time. But I think now I am, and I'm quite excited if viewers can look at the backs. Because it's actually quite cool. And I feel like it's been my little secret.
Yeah, that pile of paint that's sitting on the back of your paintings, the back, is really fascinating. So, yeah, would certainly encourage people, if you're visiting that show, to look at the back. You've also created a couple of quite large works. So a piece that was at the art fair in November 2022, I think. It's an enormous piece. It was 1.5 by 2 metres, I think. So you're obviously not put off by working at large scale either.
No, I like a good challenge, I say. whether support material is small or big, I just personally need to go on creative endeavours that kind of push myself, because I want to think, I want to let my thinking be pushed, and I want, to expand the way that I consider making, and even like going to a big size, in that your brain kind of like thinks about things in new lights and like new ways. And then when you go back down really small, you kind of have those things that are in consideration, and you can kind of like put that into the small works.
So again, but making sure that you're constantly pushing yourself.
I think so. I hope so.
Well, speaking of pushing yourself, because you've also pushed yourself with combining acrylic and watercolours on canvas, and that seemed to come at a time around COVID lockdown. So those works that were on canvas that were at SANC October 2021, a show called Hate to Rain on Your Parade. So why the switch then?
Well, that body of work was all just watercolour. Mm. It was just all watercolour.
No acrylic
in those works. It was just watercolour, which is, again, I mean, firstly, I mean, I made that body of work when I was out in Karikari, at the Karikari residence. It wasn't my residence. I had two friends that actually got the residency.
Whose residency were you crashing?
It was Tidda Walsh's and Rhys King's. Mm. Yeah, it was their residency. And I went out for a week just to, you know, hang out. And then we got pulled into lockdown. And in that, I was stuck out there because, firstly, I don't drive. And then Tidda went home because she's got kids. Mm. And Mama Bear, you need to do that. And so I didn't feel that it was going to be right if I left my good pal out there by themselves to go insane for however long. So I stayed out there with Rhys. And in that, I had nothing. I just had a backpack with me and some watercolours and maybe like 3 pieces of glass, because I thought that, okay, I would make a little bit when I'm there for a week. But essentially, I had nothing else.
Oh, so you ran out of materials?
I didn't bring materials because I didn't think I would be on this residency. I brought enough to, like, hang out for a week. And so that's all I had with me.
So necessity forcing creativity.
Yeah. And then I think what stemmed from that time being out there is I just missed people. Mm. And I could see people and everything, and it was all just like geometrical shapes, and I could see, like, there was a lot of shapes going on. When you start fixating on, like, nature, you, like, break it down. And it's, like, beautiful, organic, and then you've got, like, some, like, harsh elements. Yeah.
And Katie's a place that does that.
Yeah. Yes. So I was slowly going insane, longing for people. And
we all were in COVID lockdowns.
Yeah, we were. But, yeah, no, that's where I made the work, was out in Karikari.
Mm. Well, that's probably not a bad segue into approaching work. So how do you work? You try and keep a strict 9-to-5, or do you need some pressure getting closer to commitments, either to your, you know, dealer or public shows, to generate some work?
I think it's a bit too early just to say whether it's the second one that you said. I think it's a bit too early to be like, yes, that's the way in which I work. But no, I'm not a 9-to-5 gal. I don't like working 9-to-5. I am a night owl. I like working in the evening where everything's quiet and I can hear myself thinking. And I also just really like sleeping in the morning. So, like, yeah, there's that too. I mean, it doesn't not help having pending deadlines. And the way that I approach working and the way that I make is very, like, lethargic, that there has to be the sense of just, like, going in and causing havoc. And so if you gave me a big time frame, I don't know if I would. Yes, I would make a lot of work, but I don't know. It's something that I'm trying to question myself. Like, would I make any differently? I don't think
I
would.
Well, you're still settling into practice, I suppose, in a way. So still figuring that out.
Yeah, that's what I think. It's too early.
Too early.
Too early to know.
Last question that I'm asking everyone.
Oh,
yeah. Removing any limit of budget or whether a piece is held, like in a public institution, so any work or any artist that you could lay your hands on in the world, you know, what work or artist would you want to live with or love to live with?
Marlene Dumas, yeah. She's just amazing, yeah. And I've always looked at her ever since, I look up, I just like her paintings, yeah. I get really, like,
what do you feel in them? Why do you like them?
I don't think you can even explain. I can't even explain. It's just, like, breathtaking. And, like, I can't even apply language to the way in which I really, what I feel and how I think about them. I don't think many works do this to me.
But it was a very quick answer, so an absolute certainty.
No, I would love. So if you're listening. I would love a Marlene Dumas. Yeah. That's my answer. I love.
Great.
It's beautiful work.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Good Oil. Your next chance to see new work from Hannah is at the Te Uru Gallery in Te Tārangi, Auckland, at her first public solo exhibition, Running With Scissors, from Saturday 12 August to Sunday 12 November. Then at Laurie Payne Gallery in Kirikiri Roa, between the 23rd of August and the 23rd of September. Or contact Jana Millers in Wellington or Laurie Payne Gallery in Hamilton for available work. I'd really appreciate it if you would rate, review, and share the podcast. That all helps other people discover the show. Please join me next time for episode 10 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.